Hi, my name's James O'Barr. I wrote, created, illustrated, and pretty much did everything but printed The Crow in the early 80s. Actually, it took about 10 years to complete the entire 300-page book. But I did it as a result to a personal tragedy. My fiancé was killed by a drunk driver. So right now I'm just giving you a little background information on the film before we start this thing, so you know where it came from and how it proceeded to become a film. I had done 4 issues of the comic book, a small press black and white book for a Detroit-based company called Caliber, which was essentially a guy called Gary Reed who owned 4 comic book stores, and he saw this unused talent coming into a store every Friday to buy the new comics, and thought, well, you know, why don't I publish some of this stuff that these guys are showing me? So we did an initial print run on The Crow of 10,000 copies, and it sold out almost immediately, which was a surprise to me because I knew it had a core audience out there, but I had no idea that it would be that vast. I mean, I was more influenced by the music of the time than the comics of the time. And there weren't a whole lot of comics in record stores. So that it actually reached its audience, you know, I was thrilled. And, you know, I ended up getting 50 to 60 fan letters a week, which I answered all longhand, and as such I have an incredible phone book of friends where I can stay pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Not too long after the 3rd issue came out, Hollywood came calling. Someone named John Shirley, a science fiction writer who I admired, who was part of the cyberpunk movement of the early 80s, that was basically inspired by Blade Runner, had seen it and thought it would make a nice film, and he showed it to a producer friend of his, Jeff Most, and they contacted me about doing it as a film. I optioned the film to them for $1,500, and an option is pretty much you're not allowed to offer it to anyone else for sale. They have their first rights to it. You know, it's like 1 out of 1,000 of these things ever gets made. So to me, it was just like free money. I was working on cars at the time, so comic books was just a hobby for me. And, you know, $1,500 went a long way in buying supplies and cat food. I took the money and I didn't think much of a film ever happening. But less than 2 years later, Ed Pressman became involved. He liked the basic story idea. Not that there wasn't a lot of arguing and haggling and slamming down of phones and walking out of meetings and telling people they were full of shit. I tell these people, you know, you have everything here to make a cake and you fuckers want to make cookies. You know, it's like, why did you buy this thing for me? We want to change everything from the makeup on his face to eliminating the whole gothic atmosphere of the thing. They wanted a death wish with zombies, and I refused to be a part of that. And luckily, to everyone's benefit, Alex Proyas, the director, and Brandon Lee became involved, and things got back on the right track. So, how we're going to do this kind of low-tech thing, since we couldn't do an actual DVD voiceover thing, is I'll talk my way through it, and I'll tell you, you know, I'll do a 1, 2, 3 pause, and you either, you know, pause your VCR or pause the DVD player, and then we'll, change CDs. And then we'll do the exact opposite on that, you know, 1, 2, 3 play, and then hopefully we can keep this all synchronized. Okay, so 1, 2, 3 play. Dimension is a subsidiary of Miramax Films. It's basically low rent films that they don't want to be attached to. All the credits are at the end except for Brandon and the Crow because it was a tribute to Brandon that this was his film. This is Alex Proyas, the director's vision of Devil's Night in Detroit, which, since I came from Detroit, from what I understood, this happened all over the world, but I've since learned that only in Detroit, on the day before Halloween, the local people burned down the abandoned crack houses, and for years it was an international event where people came from all over the world to film it. It has since subsided, and it's called Angel's Night now. Another thing I'd like to point out is this opening bracket by Rochelle Davis about buildings burn and people die was written by Waylon Greene, who wrote he wrote Sorcerer for William Friedkin. He wrote The Wild Bunch. He kind of came in and wrote these opening and ending bookends, which I think really add a lot of soul to the film. I think it set things up perfectly. And Rochelle Davis, being her first film, she's really a sweetheart, and she was diligent and worked very hard on all of this stuff. I hope she has a future in films. This is Ernie Hudson, who everyone knows as the Black Ghostbuster. This scene kind of bothered me because it was very, very close to what actually happened in real life, as Brandon was to be married to his fiancée, Eliza Hutton, less than a week after the filming was to be ended on this film. So not only was Brandon killed in the film, in the scene where the character is killed, he left behind a woman who has a wedding dress and not much else left in her life at that point in time. Sophia Shinas, who plays Shelley in this film, was kind of a last minute pick. I think she did a nice job visually. She's a good contrast with Brandon. Her voice was overdubbed by somebody else for various reasons. I think mostly that she was Canadian and the accent was bothering some of the Hollywood people. I thought this was really nice here, Dove Honing, the editor, where he just kind of freeze framed this segment here, because we jump ahead a year in time, and basically it's telling you that people's lives have not moved on in that time. They're kind of stuck in this flux where, you know, the people they love have died, and they don't know how to move on with their lives. Okay, and now we cut to, there's several scenes that are intercut here, and there's a large section that's missing out of this as well. T-Bird's gang is destroying a video arcade, and in the original cut, there was a woman who was running the arcade, who they duct taped to a chair, and David Patrick Kelly, who plays T-Bird, took delight in torturing her with cigarettes and a Zippo lighter. But with the advent of the accident with Brandon, the MPA board was very sensitive to things. All things violent in this film. In fact, you got an X rating three times. And it cost, I believe, $15,000 every time you submit a film for a rating. And after three times, they were starting to panic because the MPA does not tell you what they object to. They just give you a rating. And so they just started cutting things randomly. There are a lot of things missing in this film that I think nowadays, if it wasn't for the coarse language and things, I think this would probably be a PG-13 type thing. Ernie Hudson was a very sweet, cordial guy on the set. He agreed to the character chain smokes for the whole film, and he had just quit smoking, but he agreed he would smoke throughout the film if the character could quit in the final scene. So there's some little trivia for you. The hot dog vendor, whose name I've forgotten now, originally the Rochelle's name was Sherry, because in the book I wanted it to be similar to Shelley, because I wanted to draw parallels between the two. So they actually had to do about six cuts of this thing because the vendor kept calling her Sherry, and her name had been changed by that point. So here's the arcade sequence where David Patrick Kelly and Angel David and the rest of the bad guys crash the place. David Patrick Kelly, of course, an amazing actor who's been, his first film was The Warriors. He was in Commando, Last Man Standing. He's literally done probably 20 or 30 films. And he researches every role, just very thoroughly. I talked to him for hours on end about this character. He spent a lot of time in Detroit, so he liked the idea of playing the character T-Bird. These are actually scenes of Brandon crawling out of the grave. It was about 20 degrees. They had rain machines going the full time. They had to run something called ethyl glycol through the rain machines to keep them from freezing up. And everyone on the production crew was terrified that Brandon was going to come down with flu and they were going to have to cut down the production. Because in a few short seconds here, he rips off the entire half of his apparel, and he's walking around in nothing but pants. They have set off the timer to go off in the arcade, and in the original version, Brandon is drawn to the arcade because he realizes something's about to happen, and as he opens the back door, the arcade explodes, and he's blown back about 15 feet. That scene was edited for time reasons, or, I'm not sure what, but the actress's scene was entirely removed, and the connection between him and the death of the arcade owner are just eliminated in this. Brandon is not play acting when he's shivering in these things, because it was freezing cold. Everyone had three or four coats on, gloves, hoods. This is the explosion where Brandon was blown back like 15 feet. This entire film was filmed at night with rain machines going, and everyone told me it was the most miserable set they had ever been on. These crows were amazing. Some of them, I think, were smarter than the actors. There are a lot of these tarot card images painted on the sides of buildings. I think it was a girlfriend of the production designer who put them on there, but they were very mysterious, and she wouldn't give any clues as to what they meant, but Alec Proyas liked the look of them. DreamQuest did some digital imaging of Brandon. They like to, you know, I'm not to downplay their creativity or the things they've added to other films, but what they added to this film was literally about 6.5 seconds of film, which is, you know, virtually nothing, but, you know, they were on, you know, like 2020 and various other news programs, like they saved this film. But that shot of Brandon walking through the hallway and the pull-away shot from the round window of Brandon with the makeup on are the only two segments that they composited from other film. A lot of these scenes were completed by Brandon's stunt double, Jeff Cadiente, but I think it would draw something away from what Brandon brought to the film. So I'm not going to point out what's Brandon and what's not. But I'd like you to know he did virtually 90% of all of the filming you see here. There were just simple cuts and things like that had to be redone, including this scene where the character dies, was basically refilmed because the original segment had Brandon walking through the door holding a grocery bag. And they didn't want any confusion that the actual film of Brandon being shot was actually in the film. That film went straight from the camera to the courtroom. The judge viewed it, and it was destroyed right after. It was burned. So there are virtually no photographs, film, or any documentation of a photographic nature of Brandon. Of Brandon being shot. So if you see anything like that, it's bullshit. It doesn't exist anymore. This is David Patrick Kelly. Just an amazing actor. Angel David plays Skank. I think this is one of his first films. This is Michael Massey on the left, who unfortunately was the actor that was involved in the accident with Brandon. The swallowing the bullets was an idea that John Shirley brought to the table. I thought it was a nice effect, you know, that they're showing their allegiance to each other by swallowing these bullets, and it also gives you the hierarchy of the gang, you know, who's in charge and who's the lowlifes and who's the comic relief. I always called Skank the Wile E. Coyote of the Crow because, you know, he's continually involved in one fuck-up after another and survives it. I was really happy with the way the sequence turned out. The mask, you know, being straight from the comic book. I was a little hesitant about Alex Proyas' choice of colors for the flashback sequences because I thought they were a little too bright and too garish. But when I saw how muted the rest of the film was, I think in retrospect, he did the right thing in keeping the hot and warm colors in there. You know, I was afraid it was going to look too much like a cartoon. But the man's a genius, and what you see on the set has no relation to what ends up on film. I mean, when I stepped on the set, I thought, you know, this is the phoniest looking shit I have ever seen. All the lights are too bright. You know, people, it's going to look like a comic book come to life, which was the one thing I did not want it to look like. This is another Dream Quest shot with the broken glass. So with the pull away shot, there's their entire involvement, 6.5 seconds. I really like the use of the Cure's music here. I was a big fan of the Cure. They were a big inspiration on me when I was writing the book, especially Faith, Pornography, and 17 Seconds, their first few albums. Very depressing and very very aggressive at the same time. Gabriel, this cat, is in actuality my white cat, Mikos. Alex McDowell, the production designer, came to my house and saw this cat and said it has to be in the film. You know, it's a great counterpoint to Eric Allen Black. That pull-away shot was Dream Quest's last submission to the film. They did nothing after that. This is one of my favorite sequences in the film because I actually patterned the character of Gideon after John Polito when I had seen him in a Coen Brothers film. And I was just delighted when they said they had gotten him for the role. He was perfect. For playing scumbags, there is nobody that can reach his level of depravity. Miller's Crossing, he's in pretty much virtually all the Coen Brothers films. I think this is great. Even the lettering on his cap is straight from the comic book. So this is virtually like panel for panel right from the book. From what I hear, this is a lot of other people's favorite sequences as well. They filmed the shot with that's coming up here with Brandon smashing through the front door. They filmed that like five or six different times, with different angles, different speeds on the film. And unfortunately, they didn't use my favorite one, which is where Brandon, in really slow motion, smashes his head through the glass first and then walks through. And then the bird kind of glides over his shoulder. Trent Reznor, a nice friend of mine, who I've known for years. I used to give him my comic books to read on his tour bus, which is why he agreed to contribute to the film. In fact, his band was supposed to be the band that played live in the film, but contractually he was obligated to finish his album that he was working on at the time. The Crow Vision was something that the producers brought in. In the book, the Crow doesn't even actually exist. It's just kind of a fragmented part of Eric's mind, kind of the sane part of what's left of his head. They thought they couldn't possibly make that work without it being comical in the film. This is Eric exploring his invulnerability, his newfound invulnerability. You know, just delighting in the fact that he cannot be hurt anymore. This is another scene that is pretty close to the comic. I mean, they wanted to give each villain, you know, a distinctive look and a distinctive weapon. So it was decided to give him knives. And it worked out really well. I mean, Brandon's doing all of his own stunts here. You know, freezing cold. And he's just a little dynamo, unstoppable. I just, you know, I love when he's got Tintin down on the ground and he's screaming in his face and, you know, he's actually spitting at him. He's screaming so hard at him. You know, this sequence right here. This shows you the real talent Brandon had, that, you know, he was an actor. He wasn't just a martial arts star. You know, he told me this was the favorite role he had ever played, and for the first time he didn't feel like he was in his father's shadow. You know, I was really glad to have given him that opportunity, you know. When Brandon was first chosen, I mean, I liked his look, but, you know, I had seen Rapid Fire just before this, and he, even though he had the right physicality, he was just almost like too nice of a guy. Every time he hit someone, he would, like, almost apologize afterwards. And so I wasn't sure that he could be threatening enough, that he could be scary on film, because the character is definitely frightening in the book. But obviously just looking at Brandon here, you know, he has it down pat. He understands the character inside and out. The original shot of this had Tintin being stabbed about 14 times, which was also trimmed. A lot of those flyers you saw on the wall were Detroit bands, who now all owe me favors. You know, Madison was kind of a last-minute choice. It was kind of getting down to the wire. And this was filmed in an abandoned cement factory in Wilmington, North Carolina, where it was freezing. But it took about a week to actually film this, along with the actors in the foreground. And it was hard to get a band to commit to that amount of time. For the small amount of money that was being offered, when they could be on the road touring, making a lot more. This is Tony Todd, you know, whom everyone knows as Candyman. You know, he's been on, you know, every, you know, I think pretty much every Star Trek series except for the original. And unfortunately, he's the one actor I did not get to meet on this set, and he's been trying to run into me for years now, and we keep missing each other by minutes. So, Tony, one of these days. This snow globe is one of the things I'm most asked about. I don't know who actually made off with the prop. You know, but I really like, you know, the tombstone and the dead tree. I think it's you know, it's a really nice atmospheric prop, and I think they missed a major marketing coup by not putting these things out. But at the time this film was made, it was very unlikely that it was even going to get distributed, because every single studio in Hollywood passed on it because of the death of Brandon. They didn't want to be associated with it. Alex Proyas, the director, has since apologized for these gratuitous nudity scenes. He's an addict of eye candy, and he just could not resist himself on these points, so I apologize for him in his absence. Really great model work. Those things were made out of cardboard and pieces of old models. Hermit old guy in Hollywood, you just give him a photograph of a building and he goes into his little studio in the back and he makes these things out of pieces of balsa wood and plywood for virtually nothing. you know, which is how they kept the budget down to $13 million on this thing. And it looks virtually like a $50 to $60 million film, thanks to Proyas' direction and the cinematography. This is Anna Thompson, who has been in many, many films. And at the time, Michael Massey, who plays Fun Boy here, was her boyfriend in real life. Anna Thompson, you probably know as the hooker in The Unforgiven who gets her face scarred up. She's the catalyst for The Unforgiven. This is my favorite sequence because it's literally taken frame from the comic book. You can sit down with the book and match up shot for shot. They almost used it like storyboards. John Polito added some nice little expletives. The Poe references were added by John Shirley. I really hadn't thought of Edgar Allan Poe at the time, or of The Raven. But he saw the parallel there, and so he worked in some Edgar Allan Poe lines. Here's where Brandon drools. That was why Paramount passed. That one sequence of Brandon drooling, which to me, you know, just insinuates that he's totally insane, you know, but that was the sole reason that Paramount Films passed on this film, believe it or not. You know, hopefully all those executives are either fired or kicking themselves in the ass right now. The dialogue is all almost verbatim from the comic book here. Quick cut back here to Tintin and the coroner. Ernie Hudson gets to throw in a little comedy line. Essentially, they were trying to make it look like a lot bigger film than it was. It was filmed in Wilmington, North Carolina, eventually what amounted to an abandoned cement factory and an L-shaped street where they would change the fronts of the buildings. Super Mario Brothers was filmed there right after this, and they used a lot of the same set pieces that were still around. It's nearly impossible to steal a scene from John Polito, and I think Brandon pretty much pulls it off here.